and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Arctic anthropologist Aaron Kroll and Indigenous Studies scholar Judy Ramos talk about more than 900 years of interactions between people, seals, and glaciers at Yakutat Bay. This talk is a part of the Smithsonian Spotlight Series. It was recorded October 2nd at the Anchorage Museum. Throughout the talk, Kroll and Ramos refer to PowerPoint presentations, which have kindly been shared by both on our website for listeners to follow along with. Check out alaskapublic.org and scroll down to Addressing Alaskans on the right to find those links. And without further ado, anthropologist Dr. Aaron Kroll starts us off.
Okay, I think we'll get started. A warm welcome to this evening's Smithsonian Spotlight entitled The Glacier's Edge, The Peopling and History of Yakutat Bay Since AD 1000. And I'm Aaron Kroll, the Alaska Director of the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center, and the principal scientific investigator for the Yakutat Seal Camps project that we'll be talking about tonight. I regret to say that our planned first speaker, Elaine Abraham, who is the senior researcher for the Yakutat project and distinguished Gnaekwan clan elder and leader, can't come tonight, but her daughter Judy is here to also present on the project. Judy Ramos has served her community and tribe in many capacities and is now on the faculty of the Rural Development Program at UAF, and she's also working there on her PhD in Indigenous Studies based on her research with Yakutat elders and seal hunters. So Judy and I will be co-presenters tonight. And I will begin to give an overview of the project. The archaeologists are following the trail of Yakutat ancestors, seeking to confirm oral traditions that are centuries old. And clans originating to the north and south, speaking different languages, came to Yakutat Bay, which is a place of truly extraordinary abundance and ecological diversity. The Eyak, Otna, Tlingit, clans arrived in several waves, and others came to trade, the Chugach, Tsimshian, and Haida. The oral traditions of Yakutat tell about the founding of the clans, about war, migration, the retreat of the great glacier that once filled the bay, and the villages and seal hunting camps where people lived in former times. And this panorama of history that's known and recounted by surviving elders and was recorded by anthropologists, including John Harrington and John Swanton and Frederica de Laguna, spans almost 1,000 years and has been passed down in the form of the epic narratives of oral tradition. And these narratives are an essential endowment of Yakutat culture and foundation of identity. And yet some historians and anthropologists have dismissed indigenous oral traditions, questioning that they could convey true history. In the absence of a written language, a written record, wouldn't these stories change over time, gradually transforming from fact to legends to myth, losing all reliability? Now, one way of resolving this issue is to compare oral traditions with the independent evidence of the past, such as archival documents and images recorded by outside observers, with geological data that record the movements of glaciers and other changes to the landscape that are described in the Yakutat narratives, and the physical evidence of scientific archaeology. Now, this kind of collaborative exploration combines and cross-checks different ways of knowing about the past. For example, by relocating sites along the pathways of Yakutat history and dating them using radiocarbon analysis, archaeologists can provide a time frame for the events that are described. On the other hand, the rich oral content of oral tradition conveyed through time by the vehicle of language allows the archaeological evidence to be interpreted. These investigations have pragmatic as well as intellectual purposes. Yakutat and other Alaska Native communities have struggled to regain or retain their tribal lands, and historical and archaeological evidence of traditional use is paramount in legal decisions. There's also great concern about the declining population of seals, which are the most important food resource at Yakutat Bay. And the seals gather in the ice flows near Hubbard Glacier to feed and give birth to their young. So is the decline, the declining population of seals, which is quite dramatic, is that due to overhunting, climate change, or other factors? And the answer may lie in the archaeological and environmental evidence in the record of human-seal interaction over the past centuries. And for the survival of a threatened language and culture, it's surely beneficial for the young people of Yakutat to take part in the exciting discovery that the stories that our parents and grandparents tell have a very tangible reality. So I wanted to look briefly at several phases of Yakutat history, combining these knowledge sources, and starting about 900 years ago when the combined mass of Hubbard and Malaspina glaciers still filled Yakutat Bay. And at that time, people inhabited sites southeast of the bay, such as Diuganet on the Lost River, that's shown there with a radiocarbon date of 784 AD. And in oral tradition, these are remembered as Eyak clans, the Yinyedi and Hnyedi, that had moved into the region from their original homeland to the north. So as the ice began to retreat during the medieval warm period, new land was exposed, and other early settlements were established. And this summer, we were investigating one of these early sites at Spoon Lake on the west side of the bay. Now, this area around Spoon Lake is remembered as one of the oldest seal hunting places. And about 800 years ago, when the settlement was built, the glacier stood close by, and seals would have congregated in the ice that was floating by the glacial front there. And the shoreline was farther inland than it is today. So you can see the location of the site by Spoon Lake and the approximate position of Malaspina Glacier at that time. Now, the remains of the village today are in the forest, but when people lived there, there would have been few or no trees. And here we are beginning our work at the site this summer. So on this map of the site, you can see three large house pits and a lot of the smaller pits that mark the locations of underground food caches. And there seem to be two seasonal groupings, a pair of summer dwellings there, and then a single deep house pit, probably used in winter and surrounded by food storage caches. And our excavations are marked in white there on the in structure one. And we carefully recorded the layers of soil, the cultural features, and the artifacts that were found inside the structure. And structure one seems to have been a dwelling that was also used as a smokehouse. Here's the shape of the original house pit, which had a floor that's considerably below the surface of the ground. And then when we excavated inside, we found a central hearth down in the bottom and a kind of earthen bench around the sides where there were a number of additional smaller fires. There was even a large flat rock there that was probably used for seating or as a table. Now, over this building, there was probably a framework, wooden framework, something like this, covered with strips of bark. And meat and fish would have been hung from the rafters to cure in the smoke. tools that we found inside the house were quite interesting. They included some of these sharp, slender ground slate blades that you can see in the upper left. And they're probably dart or arrow points that were used in sea mammal hunting. And next to them are chert microblades that functioned as tiny knives. And there were micro awls. I think you can probably see the very sharp points on those two awls that were probably used for making stitching holes in leather or maybe fish skin. Then there was a double-ended carving chisel, and then knives and scrapers that were made from beach cobbles. And these are scraping tools, as elders have said, that were traditionally used for preparing seal hides. So the Spoon Lake site gives us a glimpse of the first people to come to the Yakutat area at the end of the Neoglacial period. And the artifacts are culturally Athabascan or Eyak rather than Tlingit, confirming knowledge that has been passed down about the ethnic origin of the original inhabitants. So let's move ahead to another phase of Yakutat history. So as the ice continued its retreat, it paused in this mid-bay location in about 1400 AD. And the sites from this area include Klakuan, which is also known as Old Town, a night island which dates to the 16th century. And according to the oral traditions, this night island, which is known by its Eyak name of Gunawas, had only recently been uncovered by the glacier at the time it was first occupied. In these narratives, Tlakuan is portrayed as a large and important village, the first home of the Atna clan called the Gunawan, who migrated to Yakutat from the Chitna Copper River area, and who bought Night Island and Yakutat Bay from the Eyaks using native copper they brought from their homeland. And Frederica de Laguna, very well-known Alaskan anthropologist, also did archaeological work at Old Town in the 1950s. And among the artifacts she found were copper tools like these arrow points, knives, and pins, which give clear evidence of the arrival of these Copper River immigrants. Now, the narratives and place names indicate that so many people lived at the Old Town site that the earth shook with their footsteps, and that Raven fell from the sky when he tried to fly overhead, overcome by smoke from its many hearths. And De Laguna found only four houses at the site that are indicated on the left-hand side there. But this summer, we discovered many more in an area to the east, which brings the archaeology in closer alignment with the oral traditions. It really was quite a large village site. Now, our goal wasn't to replicate De Laguna's large-scale excavations, but to resample a small part of the midden using modern techniques that weren't available to her. We dug a small trench behind a former plank house in an area where the residents disposed of food remains and trash. And you can see the type of house indicated there on the top, and then how it fit over its archaeological footprint, this very large pit that's about 50 meters long, and the trench just on the north side of that. So here's our work in progress this past July. This was a very slow excavation because this trench was so full of preserved material that you had to work very slowly. We collected from the trench, we collected artifacts for cultural information. We collected charcoal samples for radiocarbon dating, and we can use much more precise techniques than were available to De Laguna. We collected over 2,000 animal bones for identification, and this will reveal the subsistence practices of the Old Town community. We're going to be studying the oxygen isotopes that are found in the marine shell, and this is a very interesting way to discover the changing water temperatures in Yakutat Bay over time. They were probably considerably colder, especially during the Little Ice Age. And also, we'll be doing DNA studies of the teeth and bones of seals because we're very interested in where the seals came from. They also migrated to Yakutat Bay from other subpopulations around the Gulf of Alaska. So you can see that a site where bone is really well preserved is both a cultural and a biological archive that can show how climate and maritime animal populations have changed. Now, the artifacts from the site included a barb for a halibut hook and identified by Yakutat canoe builder Fred Bemis, who was visiting the site that day. There was a bone arrow point used for hunting or warfare and shown with some others that were found by De Laguna, and a decorative copper cone made out of native copper that would have been sewn to regalia. And we found the base of a seal harpoon, and that correlates with the hundreds of seal bones that were found in the trench. And we know that the glacier and its floating rookery of seals was nearby at this time, you remember from the map, and it appears that hunters were going out from the village and returning with their catch rather than needing to use distant camps as in later times. Okay, so the final historical chapter takes place once the ice retreated to its present-day location in the inner part of Yakutat Bay, which is also known as Disenchantment Bay. This was Alessandro Malaspina being disappointed it wasn't the Northwest Passage, so he was disenchanted. It set the stage, this retreat and the opening up of Disenchantment Bay set the stage for the great sealing camps of the late 19th century. And one of these was Kekotlia. You can see it labeled there. And then here's during our excavations last summer in 2013. Now, Kekotlia was actually three different sealing camps or locations. And I'm just going to talk about the largest part, location one, locality one, by Indian Camp Creek. By the late 19th century, a new, completely new seal hunting pattern had emerged in Yakutat Bay. Each spring during late May through June, the entire population of Yakutat Village moved to Disenchantment Bay for seal hunting near the recessed glacial front. And here we see their camp as photographed in 1899 by the Harriman Alaska Expedition. And for the first time, people had access to store-bought tents and clothing and guns that they were purchasing from the Alaska Commercial Company and other traders. At the seal camp, they lived in canvas tents, but they also used these traditional bark-covered smokehouses, much like the ancient one that we excavated at Spoon Lake, to preserve the seal meat and hides and to render oil from the seal blubber. So you can see, for example, that top photograph shows a good view of the seal of one of these smokehouses, and then several along the bottom as well. Now, it seems that related families living in adjacent tents may have shared a single smokehouse. There's kind of one smokehouse for each group of tents, as you can see. And one hypothesis that we have, and I really want to talk to Elaine and others about this, is that the spatial arrangement of households at the camp may have replicated the social arrangement of the six lineage houses at the Winter Village site on Kantak Island at the same time. A small section of the late 19th century camp survives along the shoreline today, and it's indicated in the lower photograph, same view. But the white area is where a piece of this camp has been preserved. And we found this camp in 2011 in part by walking around the landscape with the Harriman photographs until we could line up the ridge line shown in the photograph with the ridge line at the site. we felt quite assured that we were standing in the right place at that point. Now, 3 months after the Harriman visit in June of 1899, there was a very large earthquake that lifted the land and shifted the campsite inland from the current shore, so that it now occupies a terrace that has become thickly overgrown with alders, as you can see there. And this is a depiction of the modern terrain. So there's the beach storm berm behind it, an erosion channel that has cut down from across the delta, and then this uplifted terrace where the site is located. And then those are rock outlines of these tents and bark houses on this surviving part of the terrace. A lot of it has been eroded away, but we very fortunately have this surviving piece of the 1899 camp, which was actually used from the 1870s through the early 1900s. The smaller rocks that you can see, so here's one of those structures. The smaller rocks held down the edges of the tents, and the larger ones on the outer side, on the outside, were for tying lines. And here's the two of those rock outlines with the clusters of artifacts found inside. And they include items that reflect family life, crafts, hunting, and the broad shift in material culture that had taken place as the people became consumers of Western goods. These included hundreds of tiny seed beads in many different colors, which match elders' memories of their mothers and grandmothers beading moccasins and regalia in the camp. This took place during lulls in the hard work of processing seal hides and blubber. And firearms, we find quite a few different brass cartridges from rifles. Firearms were available starting in about the 1870s, and they made hunting more efficient. And at the same time, a commercial market for seal skins and oil emerged through the Alaska Commercial Company. And the seal hunts in Disenchantment Bay increased and were now probably taking several thousand animals per year, partly for subsistence use now and partly for sale. And yet, it appears that even this intensified harvest was sustainable year after year, suggesting that the seal population must have been enormous compared to the present. Today, there are under 2,000 seals in the Yakutat Bay population. I really am very interested in finding out from a seal biologist what size population you would need to support a harvest of 3,000 to 4,000 animals per year and not have the population crash. I suspect it. Maybe it's 100,000, I don't know. Taken together, the oral, archaeological, and historical data on seal hunting that I've been discussing from the 16th century through the 20th centuries might yield a better understanding of the balance between human and natural factors in the fluctuations in seal numbers. And I mentioned in the beginning that archaeology can be the basis for indigenous land claims. Our discovery of the archaeological remains of the Kekotlia seal camp, which had eluded previous researchers, may open the way for reapplication for native ownership under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, previously denied because oral and photographic documentation of traditional use in this area was judged insufficient. In 2013, during a community visit to view the results of our archaeological work, the Gnaekwan conducted a traditional ceremony of repossession, reclaiming a place that is so richly remembered in oral tradition and where their ancestors lived over a century ago. Now, that's what I have time for tonight. Judy will be coming up now. But my hope is that our combined presentations will convey some of the real excitement and potential of working in this collaborative way to join indigenous and scientific knowledge and to explore the pathways of Yakutat history. And I do want to acknowledge the great support and cooperation of the Yakutat Tlingit Tribe, Sealaska Heritage Institute, Sealaska Corporation, the National Park Service, Forest Service, University of Alaska, and the State of Alaska, and for our research sponsorships from National Science Foundation, National Park Foundation, and the Smithsonian Institution. And thanks to all of you for listening to my part of the presentation. And I'd like you now to welcome Judy Ramos for hers.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Arctic anthropologist Aaron Kroll and Indigenous Studies scholar Judy Ramos. Their talk looks at the early anthropology of Yakutat Bay, more than 900 years of interactions between people, seals, and glaciers. This Smithsonian Spotlight talk was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on October 2nd. You just heard from Dr. Aaron Kroll. From here, Judy Ramos takes the stage.
My Tlingit name is Dakutu. I'm from the Kashkaquan clan, and I'm daughter of the Koho. My father's here. He's from the Dry Bay Kwan. He's from the Silver Salmon clan and from the Frog House. And I'm the daughter, granddaughter of the Brown Bear clan, the Tekwedi people from the Lost River people. He's from the Drum House. I had a few notes as Aaron was talking, and what I wanted to mention. I'm sorry my mother could not make it when she was thinking about what she wanted to talk. She wanted to talk about climate change. I think the picture of all those walruses up on the shore really kind of affected her. And she's fearful that some of these climate change may affect the seal too. So that was what she wanted to talk to. The main reason why I wanted to be really involved in this project is because through my life I've become aware because of a loss of indigenous knowledge. Indigenous knowledge is being lost all over the world. Language loss and indigenous knowledge is being lost because of the westernization, but also because of that many people are losing their land. They don't have access to their land anymore, and a lot of that knowledge is being lost. When we started the project in 2011, we had a few elders left that still remembered that knowledge, but I noticed this last year a lot of those elders have declined, their health has declined, so we are down to maybe 4 or 5 fluent language speakers in their mid-80s, and so this is a very crucial time to document as much knowledge of as we can. The thing that I wanted to focus on also is that indigenous people, or my people, have a different kind of view of time, and that's we have a very, we talk about the mythological time or ancestor time with our clan migration stories, but we're still a living history. As I introduced myself, we talked about what clan I belong to, and that relates to back to our ancient history of where we came from, the interior people. But this is also a living history because we are in the reincarnation of those ancestors from the past. My name is Dakutsu, and I'm the reincarnation of the first shaman that predicted the arrival of the Russians. And my son here is a reincarnation of my great uncle. And we all are reincarnation of our ancestors. So when we are born, we are told who we are named after. And these are people in our ancient history that we are in reincarnation of. I also, when he talked about Disenchantment Bay, that that's kind of a funny name for us people because we call Disenchantment the heart of the bay. And so I think we should reclaim our original name and give it back the true name, which is the heart of the bay, because that really is our heart of our bay. So my research is mainly focused on the intangible. So one of the things that I really liked is he talked about these historical or sacred sites, because all the sites he talked about are not only historical or prehistorical, but they're all sacred sites to us. And these are not recognized by the government. The only one recognized is the O-Town. That's the only site that he talked about that is currently recognized. So I want to talk about this, that undocumented this knowledge for future generations. My great-grandchildren, we always talk about the seven generations. Harbor Seal is a very important resource for people. 2008 studies said there were about 1,462 harbor seals taken in Alaska, and Yakutat is the highest harvester of harbor seals in southeast Alaska. I did a 2001 subsistence survey, and we harvested about 262 harbor seals at that time. They were 36% of the native households are harvesting seal, and 78% of the native household were using seal. So this is kind of overview of the Yakutat area. So we not only harvest from Yakutat, but we harvest from Dry Bay and Icy Bay. Those are other major places that we harvest harbor seal. But people mainly concentrate on the Hubbard Glacier for harvesting harbor seal. When we talk about this whole area, we talk about our sacred relations to this place because we believe everything has a living spirit. So the Hubbard Glacier is seen as part of this whole area, and Mount St. Elias is kind of the what we call represents my clan. Our clan is we were the people of the Mount St. Elias. And the Hubbard Glacier is also part of this system. And we believe that Hubbard Glacier is a male spirit. So this is how we relate to Hubbard Glacier as a male spirit. So we always look at Mount St. Elias, and it's one of the things that is like our compass, and we predict our weather from the Mount St. Elias. So this is part of our beliefs about this area. One of the things that you talk about was this ceremony that we had up at there. But what we were doing was because when they go and dig in the land, we felt this is maybe disturbing the spirits of that land. So this is a blessing that when we ended, the elders did a blessing to apologize for disturbing them, but to also maintain a good relationship with the spirits in that area, and to thank the spirits in that area. So that was part of the ceremony when we did this blessing ceremony up at that area. Also to try and teach the young people that were there, we have some young people that are interested, to try and teach them our ceremonies and then from that area. So he did talk about the oral tradition, and many of our clan migration stories begins from the time of the Great Flood. This is in our oral traditions that when Raven was creating the world, his jealous uncle caused a great flood that forced all the people into canoes in the tops of the highest mountains, and a number of our clan origin stories begins with these events. So many of our clan stories begins with this flood event and the retreat of the glaciers from this area. So my clan stories begins from when we started up in the interior of Alaska, from what we call the Otna territory, Chitna. And the last elders in the past remember the story, the whole story of how we migrated over the glaciers. And most of our people died on this migration over the glacier, but a few of them survived, and those are our ancestors. When we came down to the coast, this is an unknown place. We had never seen the sea before. We had never heard of a seagull before, and people came upon the coast, and they were just amazed about this beautiful thing. They had never seen this, and they had to adapt to this new way of living along the coast. So this is part of our oral tradition. When we came to Yakutat Bay, we settled first at Icy Bay, and then we came to Yakutat Bay. The Hubbard Glacier was still at its maximum extent all the way to the mouth of the bay. So this is a story from my mother. She says, when we came there, that was a foreign country. They did not know what to eat or how to live, so the spirits of that place adopted them. They adopted the humans by showing them how to hunt seal. The humans became part of that glacier. They became friends of the spirit of the glacier. That is why we have a special connection with the glaciers and the mountains of that area. So we talked about place names. So we're really intertwined with the place names. And when I did research, there is a limit to where the Eyak names end and where the Tlingit names begin, but there's only two places along the very outer coast that have the Eyak names. So the Eyak names kind of come up halfway up the bay, and the Tlingit names cover the whole bay. Some of these names refer to the environmental change. For example, Kantak Island is Kantak, meaning lupin in Eyak. So that's the time there were no trees on the area. So the clan, also the place names refer to our oral history. So my name comes from the Quashkaquan, which is the Humpy Creek in Yakutat Bay. Quashk is Eyak, and Quan is Tlingit. So this is the place names map with Tom Florton that shows all the place names that he documented with the Yakutat elders. The other thing I'm looking at is looking at how we used to traditionally manage the territories. So this is a mapping I did of the clan territories and the Quans. So we are divided into 13 tribal territories, and we're subdivided into clan territories. So Yakutat has 3 Quan territories and 5 clan territories. So each of these clans were responsible for monitoring, protecting the resources and territories. And the clan determined when and who, what weapons a person might use and how much fish or animals they might gather. So these are some of the topics I'm looking at. This is a picture of my great aunt and my great-grandfather's Jenny Abraham from this Harriman exhibition. The role of the men and the women, the traditional training of hunters, what equipments they were using, methods of hunting, selection of animals, season and hunting, how they used to process the seal and the hide, traditional names for the seal anatomy. And there's many more questions that we can ask, but here's a few of the questions I'm looking at. So this is a grease bowl from the museum. So what is the role of the harbor seal in our subsistence economy in the past and the present? What are the roles and values of beliefs in conservation and ethical moral hunting and conservation practices? So this is a picture of how we used to harvest and process the seals in the 1899 exhibition. And the main reason that we hunted seals because we needed the seal oil for preservation, and that's the main reason we were hunting seals, was for the blubber and the fat, because that was our main way of preserving food. So looking at how we used our own indigenous science and knowledge on seal hunting. So this is one of my father talking about how they used to hunt in the past. They used these small dugout canoes, hunting those barbed spears. And then nowadays we use guns. They would use a small underwater paddle and wore waterproof gloves made from seal skin. So this is the ways to hunt. And this is a picture of my dad here when he was young hunting. So this is what they call a gudia, which is the special canoes they use to hunt in the seal. And this is, and he even remembered a song that they used to use in these gudias. So they used the prow in the front when they wanted to get through the ice, and they would flip the canoe around and use the other end of the canoe when they were in the ice-free area. And they used these short paddles, which wouldn't even lift them out of the water, so they would kind of paddle really quietly to sneak up upon the seals. One of the things that they had to know is hunters had to be aware of the water, the weather, the climate, the ice pack in order to hunt in the ice. They had to be knowledgeable about seal behavior. And they had to travel. Nowadays, they travel in these small skiffs and use small caliber, low noise rounds, the first to pick off the watcher or sentry group of sleeping seals, then continue hunting the rest of the unguarded seals. So my father did a little map for me. This is a very old map of how he used to go up and hunt in ice and hunt when the water would be coming out of the fjord, it would create a lead or opening in the ice. And then this is what they called hunting along the edge. That it would open up into a pack of seals. That's where they would hunt the seals. So this is it's dangerous as anyone who's been caught in the ice up there and caught in the ice pack. This is really dangerous time. And you had to be really aware of where the ice pack was when you were hunting up there. And I think some of the staff that were up there, they kind of learned how to be really careful about the ice pack conditions there. So this is some pictures. My dad, my brother over here, they were hunting a seal and they got a seal here. So this is one of the things my father was talking about, was how the correct way to shoot a seal. He says the seal throws his head back like that and the air comes out of his lungs and he sinks. That is why you have to wait until they look away from you, hit them, and it pushes their head down. But this is a video. So this is, they're fleshing out a seal here. And springtime is a real important time for harvesting seagull eggs too. It's all part of the whole subsistence rounds. They go up there, they harvest the seals, they gather the seagull eggs, and they also gather the wild celery and seaweed and other foods that are up there during the springtime. So the seal hides were very important for our economy. When we were harvesting the seals, the women would be very picky on the seal skins. And so sometimes they would target certain seals for certain hides, so the women would use them for their seal moccasins. So this is, again, the same picture, but I wanted to acknowledge all the support of my family when we were doing this. My father was quite involved with teaching about this, and my son is one of the video persons. And beyond just being a researcher, I helped with the community facilitation and tribal liaison. And I helped bring to the project my knowledge of the local community and then my environment and my family support. And also I was provided the community and tribal accountability for the project. So it's real important when you do a project like that that the tribe always keeps you, and the community always keeps you accountable for your research. So this is the website, and I know Aaron has created this website, and there's a lot of information on there, and there are some videos on there, but also I think there will probably be a curriculum and documentary. And the summer, this last summer's First Alaskans Magazine doesn't have has an article on the project. So these are other ways that we're sharing the results of the research. And this is my acknowledgement. So Gunachish, thank you.
From here, the talk moves into a question and answer period with the audience.
Sure. I would like to ask Judith Ramos, I don't understand if people came over the glaciers, like in the oral history, and spoke Eyak and came from the interior, how did there end up to be Tlingit people?
They came from the Chitna River, and they came over the Barren Glacier, and they ended up in Icy Bay, which is just north of Yakutat. And at that time, we came over, we were Otna people, we were Athabascan people. And people, the Eyaks were living along that coastal area, and the Tlingits were living in the Yakutat area. The Eyak place names goes all the way to Yakutat, so this is kind of piecing together language and oral tradition to kind of figure out who was where and things like that. And that's all part of this research, is we're kind of piecing together where the Eyak was when we came down, and we're originally Otna. The Tlingits at that time were probably living in Lost River. And so it's a puzzle, and I think it's what we're trying to figure out with the oral history, the place names, and the research he's doing.
And we could just add that the Tlingit arrival in Yakutat Bay was somewhat later, and coming up from the south, as Judy mentions. There was a substantial expansion of people coming up all the way from, you know, Icy Strait and the Huna area, but then into Dry Bay. And so that movement was from the south into Yakutat Bay.
In the Otna, I mean, the Athabascan were coming down the Alsek, too, from the interior down the Alsek River.
A member of the audience asks if she can jot down two video links from Judy Ramos's presentation. Both are linked to on our website at alaskapublic.org.
There is a trailer for the documentary film that we're creating, which is on Vimeo. That's the Vimeo address there. So take a look at that. Kai, Judy's son, along with Brandon McElroy and others have been filming all 4 years. Fantastic interviews with many people in the community and elders and hunters, filming the seal hunt, filming the archaeological research. I think there's a great story, so we're working on that as a separate project.
Okay, thanks. Really wonderful presentations. Thank you, both of you. The question is just whether you're done with the archaeological part, or are you still midstream, or are there more summer projects to go on first? And second, when do you expect the results of the various tests of the animal remains and so forth?
Oh, well, thanks. I guess that's for me. We've just finished the last season of field work funded by our present grant from National Science Foundation. I don't think the archaeology will ever be done, but we've used up our current grant funding, so there may be, we may go back and do more, but there certainly will be a little bit of lapse in time. Right now, the archaeology lab, which is upstairs here in the museum, is full of 3 years of material, which we are working with, cataloging, and we'll be getting the different kinds of analysis that you mentioned done this winter, identifying those several thousand bones, getting the radiocarbon dates and the DNA analysis. So I don't have any of those results to report, but they'll be coming soon. And Judy and I just met to consult about the publication of a book. We hope that will be a compilation of all the contributors and lines of research, and we would love for that to come out with University of Washington Press. That's what we were discussing. So a few years, 2-3 years down, I would say. So.
This question is for Aaron, mostly, I guess. You mentioned at the beginning that there was evidence of Tsimshian coming to Yakutat to trade. So since that must have been in the historical period, is that historical evidence or archaeological evidence? And then what was it that they were trading back and forth?
It's one of the extraordinary things that I did not mention about Yakutat Bay is that the seal resources there are so great that people were coming in the 19th century anyway from all the way from hundreds of miles away to the south. So Tsimshian people did come up to trade. Other Tlingit groups came up from Juneau and Sitka and Huna, and all would go to Yakutat because there was no other place like it for hunting seals. And there are some good, and sea otters too, and there are some good stories about the interaction with the Tsimshians that Judy might want to comment on.
Well, we have a song that we do, a Tsimshian song that we do, and it's part of the trade relations we had. There's a place in Icy Bay which is named after where a Tsimshian, almost Tlingit Tsimshian battle took place. And my dad tells a story where they were shooting a sea otter, and they both shot it at the same time, and they identified with the arrows, and they were going to start. The Tsimshian had these better guns than we did. I don't know what kind, but my dad remembers they had these ones. We had the one-shot ones. We had the ones that you had to reload and things, but the Tsimshian had the better guns where you didn't have to reload, so we knew we were going to die. But there was one elder who knew the Tsimshian word to say, stop. And so they stopped, and there was no battle. And so that one word saved us from being killed off by the Tsimshian. But the other story was the Tsimshian came up and there was a dance-off, and we won. Next, he says the following year they were going to come up and they were going to beat the heck out of us, but a big Gulf storm came in and killed all of them. All the Tsimshian died, all their boats were spread out for the whole bay, all the way down the coast. So that's another story of the ongoing trade that was happening between us and the Tsimshian people.
So the record of that is mostly an oral record about the Tsimshian interactions.
Thank you. Is there any history of the Chilkats in the area or Aleutics?
Yes, to both. There's mention that Chilkat hunters, traders, it came up at least once. That's mentioned in one of the stories that was told to Tom Thornton, I think. And then, there's quite a bit of interaction with people from Prince William Sound, so Chugach, Sukpiak, or Aleutic people who came down. It may have actually been resident in Yakutat Bay at some time in the past. And usually the history that I've heard is more one of conflict with the Yakutat people, both when the Chugach people came down to Yakutat and when the Yakutat people went to Prince William Sound. It was usually not a friendly encounter.
Yeah, there's a place up north we used to battle back and forth, and that one site on the north end of Kantuck was a lookout for the Chugach coming, because they were always coming up to kill us, or we were going to kill them. And there's one place in up north, we call it Mummy Island, where we went up and they killed all of us, and all our bones are still there, so they've been trying to get us to come and do a peace with that one place where all our bones are, of our people are in that area. So, yeah, and the Chilkat story is more from Dry Bay. My father's area down there with the stories, the interactions with the Chilkats are more with the Dry Bay people, which is a little south of Yakutat Bay.
One interesting dimension of this, too, is that when I mentioned the relations with the Alaska Commercial Company, and the Yakutat people used to go, they used to paddle all the way up to Prince William Sound every year to trade at Nuchek, the ACC post that the company had taken over from the Russians in 1867. And the people basically used to hide when the Yakutat canoes would show up. They were just because of this history of conflict. But then on the other hand, a lot of Chugach people came to Yakutat Bay to sea otter hunt for the Russians. And so there were fleets of Sukpiak kayaks that were in Yakutat Bay. So a lot of the interaction dates back to that Russian period too. Okay, well, I want to thank you all for coming. And I wanted to just make note, this is a monthly program, Smithsonian Spotlight. And November 6th, so it's always the first Thursday of the month. So next month is Terry Rothgar, November 6th, a very well-known Tlingit weaver. And then December 4th, Sonia Kelleher Combs is giving a presentation as part of the program. So please come to those. I'm sure they'll be excellent. So thanks again for coming out tonight.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Arctic anthropologist Aaron Kroll at the top of the hour, followed by Indigenous Studies scholar Judy Ramos. Their talk on Yakutat seal camps delves into more than 900 years of interactions between people, seals, and glaciers. This Smithsonian Spotlight talk was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on October 2nd. If you want to see the PowerPoint presentations referred to throughout the program, check out our website at alaskapublic.org. And scroll down to the Addressing Alaskans link on the right. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. to let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.